Monday, March 27th, 2006, then we're going to take up House Bill 418 today. And House Bill 492 after that. And Mr. Lang, we had stopped, we're going to take up 492 after 418. Mr. Lang, you had only briefly shown us the cover page of this presentation you'd done last time, I think last Wednesday. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead and provide us information on the bill.
Okay, my name is Ian Lang, staff to Representative Paul Seaton. The overview that I'm going to give here with the PowerPoint is one of three ways that you can look at the changes under the new CS. The other ones, there's two sheets that were distributed to you today, just a summary of changes. There should be a spreadsheet. There's another spreadsheet attached. It was stapled to this summary, and it's just meant to be separated and inserted into your own presentation. I had some trouble with the original version formatting. So the intent here, obviously, is to look at whether the existing mining tax structure is the best we can do, or if we can provide a better return on investment for the exploitation of the resources without harming investment. And we provided a lot of information to you to help you assess that. The presentation and analysis don't go into those. This is just meant to give you a look at the changes.
By the way, President Representative Moses, Representative Seaton, and myself. Go ahead.
The mining industry in Alaska pays taxes to three separate bodies, obviously the federal income taxes, municipal taxes in a variety of forms, property taxes, payment in lieu of taxes, and production taxes exist in three boroughs. Generally, it tends to be exacted on coal and gravel, but in some of those, they do apply to minerals, too. The major taxes on the state level, this is not all of them, but these are the three that are primarily affected by our bill. The mining license tax, which is sort of your, well, like it says, it's your license to mine in Alaska, that applies to all mining. We'll go into further detail here in a second. Royalties and claim rentals both apply to mining activity which takes place on state land. And you've seen this spreadsheet before. This is basically a look at the major taxes on the mining industry over the past few years and revenues associated with those. These are the big three, which our bill addresses: the license tax, royalties for both mineral and coal, and the rental rates. This is your current mining license tax. This is paid by all mining operations.
Mr. Lang?
Yes.
You had handed out this FY9803.
That's just
taxes,
meant.
And then in your chart was 9804. Has this been superseded?
That's meant to replace it. And I mislabeled that new one, but it has the 04 column in it.
Oh, Representative Samuels is present. Thank you. Go ahead.
So the current mining license tax, like I said, is paid by all mining operations in the state. It applies to minerals, coal, rock, sand, gravel, everybody. It allows for the deduction of all expenses immediately incurred with to remove the product from the earth. And in addition to that, you have a 3.5-year tax exemption, which applies to all mining operations except for sand and gravel and rock, it's materials more exactly. Then a depletion allowance is also allowed. Under the current license tax, the allowance is as a percentage of gross income. And it varies from material to material, but this is one of the major changes that takes place in our bill, is that this percentage depletion is changed to a cost depletion. so that a mining company then is no longer allowed to continually deduct a percentage of that gross every year, even after costs have been recouped. And the way we have changed that is to a cost depletion, which allows for the deduction of a percent of your development expenses to be deducted that is equal to the percent of the total ore body that's mined. That's going to tend to apply to larger mines where they have a general idea of what the body is. There's additional flexibility left in the bill for the department to sort of work that out with smaller operations where they don't have the cost to or don't have the resources to go in there and look and find exactly what the ore body consists of. It also, I'm sorry, just to back up here, the mining license tax is calculated as a percentage of your net income after all these deductions, and the percentages are pretty self-explanatory. In our CS, we changed those percentages to just raise them all by 2% of net income, so the calculation is the same. This is done as an amendment to the current tax, and we add an additional bracket for income over $500,000 to be taxed at 11%. We also, in the CS, eliminate the deduction of indirect expenses, and this is primarily going to apply to much larger operations where the operating mine is a subsidiary of a larger company, and so the expenses that would have otherwise been allowed to be deducted under the on that operation aren't anymore. And like I said, it tends to be pretty negligible for most smaller single mine operators. Mineral royalties. This is the most substantial change under the CS and one of the primary issues we want to address. It is meant to be the share of mineral wealth which goes to the mineral rights holder. And every other rights holder in the state, which can include Native corporations, mineral health trust, and university lands, they all charge a royalty when mining takes place on their land. And it's really quite different than what the state charges, which is 3% of net income as calculated under the current net income tax. And what we're proposing here is a new royalty, which is called a net smelter return, and this was would put us on par with most of the other landowners. I can't go into specific contract arrangements, but most other landowners in the state now are negotiating with NSRs. And what this does is bases. One of the most significant things is that it changes the royalty from being just a profits tax to something that is actually based on the mineral value, so that we as a state are saying, okay, this mined product is worth so much, a small percentage of that is due to the state. And we do it by basing it on the first point of sale and then deducting back to where it's shipped from the mining site, and that's after crushing and grinding and preparing as a concentrate. So ultimately what you're deducting is the return from the smelter, deducting transportation expenses and smelting fees, penalties, so that you get back to that point. And that's the value that we try to assess on. It's 3%. And for non-smeltable materials, we have sort of an equivalent tax.
What's a non-smeltable?
You could have any other mineral that occurs in its native state. I think DNR would probably be a better person to ask about that. I'm not sure just what is mined in Alaska that wouldn't be smeltable under this tax. Another thing that we change in the CS is the coal royalty.
Well, Representative Wilson has now joined us.
The coal royalty, all we're doing in statute, and this is going to be true for the following changes that we go through with regards to the coal royalty, as well as the rents for coal and minerals. What we've done is taken what is currently in regulation and set that as a base minimum for our statutory demands, so that the 5% of adjusted gross value that's currently in regulation is put into statute. As you can see, it's currently 5%, 5 cents per ton. This was, I believe, adopted at statehood along with the rents and hasn't changed since. And so this just kind of sets a baseline for the administration.
Let me interrupt. Representative Grunberg is joining us. Representative Kelly is present. Representative Kelly, you're welcome to join us. I had misspoke this morning. I was thinking 418 when I talked to you about 492. 492 will come right up after this. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Ian.
The adjusted gross income for coal royalty is basically calculated like a mine mouth tax in that we take the point of sale or where it's shipped, and then we deduct back to that point. So it allows for transportation and assesses the tax at the point where it's weighed and transported. And like I said, this would be of no substantial difference to the industry because it's only adopting what's in regulation. Rents, this is another major tax or...
Mr. Lang, let me interrupt. The point of where it is weighed, how is that different from mine mouth?
Well, the terms that are generally used in mining, it's sort of a misnomer in that mine mouth or any other mineral-specific tax can be given any sort of name, but doesn't necessarily have a specific definition. But what the adjusted gross value does is takes that point of sale and deducts back to if you take the coal out with the shovel and you transport it to a crusher, you crush it and you load it on the train, say, that's the point at which it's at which that value is assessed. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, rents are another one of the major sources of revenue through the mining industry that we address in the CS. Currently in statute, both the rents for coal and minerals are rather small, but larger rents have been adopted in regulation since. And what we do here is basically adopt those bare minimums, those regulatory rates as base minimums, and then also link them to a consumer index, although, we basically link them to the Anchorage Consumer Index and require the department go back every 10 years and look at the changes and see if that is still a fair royalty or rent to charge. And those are $3 and $3.30, respectively. That is it. Can I answer any questions?
questions by the committee on the overhead.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative.
I just might clarify one thing that was a little bit confusing is on the depletion. Currently, you can deplete, you can do your depletion two different ways. You can do it by costs or by a gross value of the minerals. And what this bill does is says, okay, we're going to go to the cost. You know, you can deplete your costs, but you're not going to subtract the amount of minerals basically that are taken out of the ground. It's not going to be based on a that kind of depletion. So you get to do the cost depletion method, which is currently in statute, but you can't select the other method, which is, you know, quite different.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
On the last slide, where it's for the coal, where it says ties the rate to the Anchorage Consumer Index, is that the way it is now, or is that the changes?
It's different for each, actually. I believe it's the minerals rent that is currently tied to the Anchorage Consumer Index, and we took that language and made it apply to the coal as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative C.
Yeah, I just might indicate that that's tied to the Consumer Price Index, but it's only adjusted every 10 years. So it's not an annual increase in the rents. It's as you can see, there's a adjustment period every 10 years established in here.
Currently, that
Mr. Lake,
I'm sorry, through the chair. I'm not sure when the last adjustment period was, but if you were to take, for instance, that coal value at the time it was adopted and to apply the Anchorage Consumer Index, it would be approximately $5.25, if accounting for inflation.
Any further questions? Anything else, Mr. Lang?
Not unless you have any other questions.
You'll have to stand by. I'll probably have some more questions. There were some folks that wanted to testify, or we had some questions for the Mr. Milius, and then also Mr. Stickle. Ms. Bales had prepared some information to the for the committee earlier this month. Mr. Milius, can you come forward? You can leave that up, Mr. Lane, if you want.
Okay.
Morning.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dick Miles. I'm the director of the DNR Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and I'm just here to answer any questions you might have.
The last time you testified was late last month and had an overhead we were going through and some handouts. I'm not sure if that was you or Mr. Stickle.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we did have some the overview that summed up the current revenues that the state takes in. It's most of that information is actually summarized in the information that Ian presented to you.
Okay. Do you have any committee have any questions for Mr. Milius on the bill? Have you been getting much feedback from the industry on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I've heard general concern from the industry, and I think they've testified at a couple of past hearings and such, but they're real concerned about what the impacts might be of changing the taxation structure on future development. I'm not.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say on this current version of the bill, I haven't heard any specific feedback on the current proposed CS for the bill.
Is there any information from the division on the potential impact to mining in the state?
Mr. Chairman, no, we haven't really assessed that. It's kind of beyond our staff's capability to really look at how the changes to the taxation structure would kind of change the economics for the industry and such. So we haven't undertaken that kind of analysis.
Okay. Representative C.
you've had a chance to review these. So do you agree that the additions on the coals and rentals are basically just putting in statute the minimums of what you're doing in regulations currently, except for changing the reapplication or the reassessment period from 20 years to 10 years?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, for the coal, yes, that does seem to be pretty much just putting into statute the way the coal is currently, the coal fees are set in regulation now.
All right. And follow up. And what is your feeling on the change from the allowance? Let me get it here, wherever it is. The depletion allowance going to a cost method on depletion. Is that going to be easy enough for you guys to work with?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we haven't really assessed that thoroughly to really answer that question.
But that follow up, Mr. Chairman, That is one of the two methods that is currently allowed in statute for people to use. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, or Representative Seaton.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Mr. Miley? So Representative Wilson.
I would like Representative Seaton to go into what you just got done saying.
Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just for an explanation on what this is right now, a depletion allowance can be used, and you can either deplete based on your costs that you put into the project, or you can subtract from your taxes a depletion of allowance based on the percent of the minerals that are no longer in the field. And what is happening is that, of course, most big mines will say, well, geez, we've used up 50% of our minerals, so we get to subtract a huge part of our tax because we've used up more of the minerals and it's not, no longer there to take. And so what we've done on the mining license tax in this version is say, you can deplete your costs, and you can take those as a deduction, but we're not going to say, well, gee, there was $1 billion worth, and now you've taken out $500 million, so we're going to let you subtract that as from your taxes. So this would come to a depletion allowance based on the costs that you're actually putting in there, but not based on the amount of minerals that are gone out of the ground.
Okay, thank you.
There was an oil depletion allowance for a while, wasn't there? In federal law?
Something you'd like have that. To ask Mr. Oil next.
I think there was in federal law. I don't think that exists anymore. All right.
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe that we have an oil depletion allowance in state
no,
tax.
No, I don't.
Or we don't write it off against our production tax.
Any further questions, Mr. Miley's? Thank you, Mr. Miley's. See, we had Mr. Stickle. Are you here, Mr. Stickle? Oh, okay. And Ms. Bales, are you online? No?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am here online.
Why don't you come forward, Nils? What we have in the file is a memo dated March 3rd from Mr. Stickle and you, Ms. Bales, on some questions related to House Bill 418, and how did you want to present the information on this?
Would you like me to...
Just summarize, if you would, and then there may be other additional questions flowing from this.
All right. The first question that you gave us was, what would be the impact of House Bill 418 on tax revenue if we excluded the Pogo and Kensington mines from our analysis?
Mr. Tomlinson.
Oh.
Just for the record, if you'd just identify yourself.
Yeah, I'm Nels Tomlinson, representing the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, sir.
In summary, there's a table, Table 1 and Table 2, that show the actual numbers. In summary, it looks as if the revenue increases would be about $1 to $4 million smaller than what we originally showed in the fiscal note when we included Kensington and Pogo Mines.
How much smaller?
My note here says about $1 to $4 million each year. That's a change in the revenue increase from the fiscal note to the new scenario.
Where in the memo, though, is it identified? In this Table 1 or 2?
Table 1 and Table 2 show the two price scenarios that were presented originally without the Kensington and Pogo mines.
And where are you seeing $1 to $2 million?
I compared that to the numbers in the fiscal note. If you have the
I see. So it's not here. It's just
that's
you're
correct.
Just reading them side by side. I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
All righty. The second question was, can we provide an estimate of the deductions taken from gross revenue to arrive at taxable income? And I can give you some numbers from 2004. These are the totals for the industry as a whole. The depletion allowance amounted to about 18% of gross income. The direct mining expenses were about 52% of gross income. and indirect mining expenses amounted to 6% of gross income.
Mr. Chairman,
do we
have something written on that, or is this, I mean, do we have a memo on that?
Well, what he read was from this memo. Have you seen this memo, March 3rd? Which I think the committee has.
March 3rd, yeah.
Everybody but a few people of the committee have it. We'll just take a quick at ease. All right, well, we're back on record. And now I think everybody has this memo we've been talking about. The Schedule A that you've been referring to in this memo, is that from based on the aggregate of the tax returns?
That's correct.
From the companies? There were a number of questions that came up while we were at ease. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Tomlinson based on the discussion while we were at ease?
Mr. Chairman, just a clarification. So this March 3rd is based on the original bill, not on the CS. Is that correct?
Chair, that's correct, sir.
And Representative Seaton, how does this analysis affect, or how is the CS affect the analysis in this section of the memo?
Mr. Chairman, it changes it considerably because what we've done is gone back to the original structure of the mining tax. Basically, we were listening to the industry having problems with basing on the gross, and so what we've done is we've gone back to the original structure of the mining tax, eliminating some of the problems of indirect costs and those kind of things, adjusted the percentages somewhat, and so that's come forward. So it's going to be a reduction from the amounts of revenue shown here. I can't tell you exactly how much. Hopefully, if this moves from committee, we'll get a fiscal note on the new CS by the time it gets the resources, and then we'll have the information.
Representative Wilson.
Is there a possibility that we could get your response on the committee substitute? Because this is the response on the original bill.
Yes, I'm sure we could redo this for the new bill.
Yeah. If that would be great.
All righty.
Ms. Bales, are you in line?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
One of the things I wondered if you could address any of the impacts of the CS on the industry. Mr. Thompson, if you could just stay there, too.
Yes. For the record, this is Joanna Bales. I'm the Revenue Audit Supervisor in the Tax Division. Basically, I mean, as you pointed out, this memo that we drafted back in early March really doesn't apply anymore to the bill because things have significantly changed in the CS. But basically what I did is I took our 2004 tax returns and I applied the changes from the CS as if they were in place. I applied those to the income in 2004. And basically, just as a quick estimate, by denying the use of percentage depletion, there's an approximate $7 million increase in the mining license tax. And then applying the new tax rates in the CS, because basically if you take a look at this bill on page 9, it takes the current tax rates and adjusts those up by 2%. And then it adds a new tax rate of 11%. And it also denies the use of a graduated tax rate. And based on those changes, there would be an increase of another $7 million a year, just based on the 2004 tax filings. So overall, the impact on revenue right at this point, the estimate is about $14 million a year.
Okay. follow-up? Representative Seaton, did you have a question?
Well, I just would, I guess, take a look at the longer-term perspective. If we looked at the fiscal note or the memo that's been put out here, remember we were graduating in under the gross tax, so if we could look out to 2011 or 2012, that's when they would graduate in, and the revenue increase was, you know, like anywhere from 30 to 40 million, $45 million, and basically what we're talking about here is a increase of $15 million under the current scenario, because it doesn't grade in like this one does. So looking out over time, you're looking at an increase from our current tax, which is about $8 million. So there would be about $15 million. So it would go up significantly, but not nearly as much as the original bill had.
Any further questions of Ms. Bales? Thank you, Ms. Bales, for that. Please stay online, if you would.
Yes, I will.
Then Mr. Thompson, number three in this memo.
All right.
Just summarize. You don't have to read all of it.
Okay. Question three asked if any economic analysis has been performed that might indicate at what point the tax burden on the mining industry becomes onerous. And the short answer is no, we haven't been able to do such an analysis. We know that increasing the tax is going to at least slightly decrease the profitability. We know that that's going to cause mines to perhaps leave a little more ore in the ground eventually than they would otherwise do. We know that that will perhaps, if there is some company that is right on the verge of profitability, this might move them from one side to the other side, but we don't know whether there is any such company in the state. So in very brief, we can't tell you exactly what the effects will be on the industry or on any specific company.
All right, it's unknown. Any other questions on that point for Mr. Tomlinson? And your final point, Mr. Tomlinson?
The fourth question was, what does the mining industry pay to the state and corporate income taxes? And the written answer you have there has some specific numbers. It was 133,000 in fiscal year 04, 120,000 roughly in fiscal year 05. But those, this is probably the really important point of that answer, those are tax liabilities from years when the mineral prices were very low. Mineral prices are much higher now, and we anticipate that in this fiscal year and the next few fiscal years at least, we will see much higher tax liabilities than those.
Is there any way to quantify the increase from last year to this year on mineral prices?
In our fiscal note, we have projections. Or let's see here, under the high price scenario, assuming that the futures market adequately predicts mineral prices and that mineral prices will stay high in the future, our fiscal note projected $20 million roughly in fiscal year 08, $18 million mining license tax revenue in fiscal year 09, and so on into the future. If mineral prices go back down to their long-term average, we'd expect $5 million in fiscal year 08. And again, this is all under the current scenario, the current tax structure. And roughly $5 million a year out to fiscal year 2011.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't understand where it says we may receive zero or more than one tax return from a company in a given fiscal year.
That's a matter of timing. Our fiscal year ends on June 30th, and so they might send that in, or it might get processed July 1st. and then we might get their next one before June 30th of the next year. So we might get two in 1 year and none in another year.
Any other questions of Mr. Tomlinson on this? All right. Thank you, Mr. Tomlinson. Let's see.
I guess.
Representative Seat.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, just if we were relating to question four there and the fiscal note is dealing with the mining license tax, were you saying that in because the mining license tax is on net revenues that we could expect that same kind of differential between, you know, like 5 and 20, so four times the amount if we're under a high-price scenario under the corporate income tax? Or were you addressing the mining license tax?
I believe that's the mining license tax.
Okay. So, and I'm just trying to clarify because I thought the chairman had asked about the corporate income tax under number four, mm-hmm. and whether this $120,000 in 05 and what kind of projection we could make. And so I'm just trying to figure out, so when we went to the mining license revenues, were we using that kind of as a surrogate for the corporate income tax and saying that the corporate income tax might be expected to go up the same amount, or were we just not answering, being able to answer that question?
Through the chair, I'm sorry, you caught me in a mistake there. Yes, this question and the answer do refer to the corporate income tax, and I was reading you mining license tax figures. I do believe that would be a reasonable surrogate. I'm afraid that I don't have a set of projections for corporate income tax for the mining industry with me today, but I do believe it would be reasonable to take those mining license tax numbers as surrogates for the increase, subject to revision on that answer, of course.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, may I interject?
Sure, Ms. Bales.
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. One of the things to make note of when you're talking about a difference between the mining license tax and corporate income tax is that the mining license tax is based on the mining activity in the state. So if you have a specific mine, that's how that tax return is prepared and reported. However, corporate income tax, we use a water's edge basis. So everything that a corporation does is dictated by its activity in the United States. So it's kind of difficult to say that if we have a large fourfold increase in mining license tax, we'd have that same increase on the corporate side, because there are many more variables, including different industries that can be reported and different activities that can be reported by a single taxpayer. So I don't know if that's clarified anything or not, but I just wanted to point that out.
And Ms. Bales, for the benefit of the public, could you define water's edge?
The water's edge, there actually are two types of corporate tax returns. The oil and gas companies file on what's called a worldwide basis. So all activity that takes place in the world is allocated to Alaska based on the Alaska activity. Water's edge is within the United States. So regular other corporations other than oil and gas corporations look at all their activity that's conducted in the United States, and then they take a percentage of their activity in Alaska, and they allocate all of their income from activities in the United States.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you. And I don't know if it's for Mr. Tomlinson or Ms. Bales. On that question number four on the corporate income taxes, how many mines paid corporate income tax in the last couple of years? Or does this all come from Red Dog Mine?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, we have about 180 mining taxpayers. But as far as corporate income tax goes, we only receive corporate returns from those that are organized as a C corporation. So I would guess, I mean, to be honest with you, I'm not real sure. I don't know if Nels knows the answer to it, because I didn't pull the information for this particular question, but I believe it would be significantly less, because we do have several of our 180 taxpayers. Several of those are just royalty holders, individual royalty owners, and then we have also S corporations and partnerships as well. So I would guess probably less than a quarter of those mining license taxpayers are C corporations and pay the corporate income tax.
And out of that quarter, I realize you're kind of shooting from the hip here, but out of that quarter, equally distributed, or do we have one or two people that are paying the whole bill here for the corporate income tax and the rest of them are all kind of in the margins?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, there would just be a few that are paying that corporate income tax.
Thank you.
That make up the majority of that, you would be correct, because it would be based on the activity that they have. Well, you're in the country, but if you look at those larger mines, they are held by larger corporations, and there are just a few of those.
Okay. Samuels.
And you would assume that that would still continue over the next couple of years, that nothing's going to change here in the next year or two? Out of the 180 mines, they're not all going to decide to incorporate and making money hand over fist now, that actually the same mines that are paying the whole thing now are going to just continue to pay a little bit more?
Yes, Representative Samuels, through the chair, that would be a correct assumption.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Any further questions? Any further testimony? Anyone else in the audience want to testify? Anyone else online want to testify? Anybody want to have any breakfast? We're going to hold the bill. I'm going to talk with the committee and the chair or the sponsor of the bill and see what we can do, where we go from here. And so we'll set that aside for now. Thank you for coming in. We have House Bill 492, and there were a number of lingering questions from last time on House Bill 492. House Bill 492 is a bill that was sponsored by the House Finance Committee by request that would transfer state interest in certain gas resources to the Alaska Retirement Management Board for the purpose of helping pay the unfunded accrued actuarial liability of the retirement systems for the state. It was offered up as an idea to get a source of revenue to pay the unfunded liability. Last time we had Representative Kelly discuss the bill, and your staff, did your staff want to have a presentation on this? Representative Kelly, did you want to come up and talk, and we can talk about list of witnesses and how we're going to continue today for the rest of the hearing?
Good morning.
I'll just mention who's online. Mr. Shefchik is online from Fairbanks, and Mr. William Van Dyke from Department of Natural Resources is online, and Brian Rogers from the University of Alaska is also online. Representative Kelly, you and I had talked about trying to get some of these folks to get some testimony in, and we will do that. And we have Mr. Barnhill from the Department of Law here is to address some of the legal issues that came up last time. So, Representative Kelly, how best can we manage this testimony tonight and your staff if you had a presentation?
Mr. Chairman, I think that perhaps in the interest of time, the best thing would be to launch right into the presentations by Brian Rogers and Bob Shefchik. As you know, the ARM Board made a presentation to this committee and also has met just at the end of last week, Thursday and Friday, I believe, and received presentations from Mr. Rogers and Mr. Shefchik. Both at this committee last week and at the ARM Board, several questions surfaced, and I think these two gentlemen are prepared to help us grapple with those questions. And the more significant ones, I think, centered on the problems with valuation of this gas interest, and particularly in advance of a gas pipeline being in place, and also the risk that the asset would not would have some difficulty meeting some of the early payout requirements. But I think we've made some progress on that, and I think, Mr. Chairman, without further input from us, we'll just go sit back down and let the witnesses.
Okay, so your staff, no, you didn't even want to testify. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll first hear from Brian Rogers, then from Mr. Shefchik, then from Mr. Barnhill, and then Ms. Bales from Revenue. So we'll do it in that order, that list.
Thank you.
Okay? So, Mr. Representative Kelly, you're welcome to join us up here. Mr. Rogers, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and give us any testimony you have on this. And we did work on this together, you and I and Representative Kelly, before the bill was introduced, so I do appreciate your input initially.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Brian Rogers, a member of the University of Alaska Board of Regents, and the regents have advanced this concept of the transfer of a major asset to balance the system's liabilities in an effort to help address the huge hole in the PERS and TERS system that has negative impacts on state government, local government, school districts, and the university. And the attempt here is to recognizing that the difference between assets and liabilities is even larger than we thought when we first brought this concept forward, that the one of the few assets that the state has that is both of sufficient value and has the prospect of producing income in roughly the same time frame as the needs of the system is the Prudhoe Bay natural gas assets. This concept would allow the freeing up of current funds to meet other needs while attempting to match the cash flows. We don't have a model of those cash flows, and I think that's one of the things that we would need assistance to make sure that, in fact, the payout is roughly in line with the cash needs of the system. In our discussion with the ARM board on Friday, it's clear that valuation is the most substantial challenge on this asset, and our recommendation, as it's carried forward in the bill, is that we attempt to have the Department of Natural Resources transfer assets of a rough value approximating the $5 billion set out in the bill, and that the ARM board would then need to get an independent third-party valuation to meet their fiduciary responsibility to see that assets and liabilities are in balance. We also know that there are some who believe that there are constitutional problems, that this represents a dedication of funds. We believe that it is a transfer of assets and not a dedication of the revenues from those assets, and that's one that I think some additional legal analysis would be useful to the committee. Rather than answer some of the specific questions that were asked, some I believe people have already received answers to, Mr. Chairman, if it is acceptable to you, I'd like to just answer questions that members may have, or at least those that I can answer.
Why don't we do that? We'll respond to any questions you may have, and then if you'd stay on the line, and as questions come up that you have some information on and or a view on, after we finish here, we'll get back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Rogers? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. The statement of freeing up current funds to meet other needs, can you explain to me what you mean by that? Which other funds are you talking about?
Under the in the FY07 budget, approximately $125 million will be the aggregate cost to state government, local government, school districts, and the university for the 5% increase in the PERS and TERS rates. So if we freeze the rates at current levels, as the bill calls for during the valuation process, that $125 million can either be represent a reduction to the spending or can represent funds available for other purposes. If we look at the projections as they were prior to last Friday, if we look at the projections once the rates hit their top point, the annual cost to state, local, school district, and university is just over $400 million per year that would be being deposited into the funds over the next 30 years. To the extent that the passage of an asset transfer allows the freezing of the rates or even a rollback of the rates to the normal cost rates, that $400 million is available for other purposes.
One thing that is, Mr. Rogers, I'm sorry, Representative Seaton, did you have a follow-up on that?
I guess I'm just a little curious because the memorandum that we have here basically from Tom Botan says that the cost of assets is capitalized, is incurred, and basically under GASB, the that last paragraph, the recorded cost is going to be at zero. So we have, I mean, we would be putting off any contributions into reducing the unfunded liability because we have a, because we're not going to have any assets there. So basically, you know, the effect of those two things, I mean, I'm just trying to find out why the effect of those two things wouldn't be the same as just saying we're not going to reduce the unfunded liability and make any payments into it.
Through the chair, if I could respond to that, I think that's an important issue, and it is correct that the for purposes of the book value of the assets being transferred, because the acquisition cost is zero, they would show up on the books at a zero value. But for purposes of calculating unfunded liability, the systems have to look at the market value of assets. Just as stock purchased at $100 that's now worth $1,000, for purposes of calculating the unfunded liability, one looks at the $1,000 current value rather than the $100 historic cost. So the actuarial work would, in terms of determining what, if any, unfunded liability would remain, would have to look at market value. That begs the question, what is the market value of these gas assets, which is what we think would require an independent appraisal.
Okay. One thing is, just in the terms of the philosophic base for the bill, the larger view, the bill identifies gas resources as the resource that's going to be transferred and is the moneymaker and is the and the asset we're going to value. Why limit ourselves simply to gas, which raises up a whole other set of issues in terms of transportation, marketing, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission involvement, and on and on? Is it simply because gas is what we're talking about this year, or why couldn't we transfer things like rental producing residential properties or land that could be built and then lease paid to the ARM board, or coal, or some other resource? Why gas? Why limit this to gas?
Through the chair, in response, the suggestion for gas was that it is one asset that is sufficient in size, and the net present value of the likely cash flows from royalty gas sales was of sufficient size. I think it is challenging to find other assets that even in aggregate add up to that kind of value. I was listening in just now on the mining license tax and heard the kinds of revenues the state receives currently from the mineral resources. The oil and gas resources, excuse me, the oil resources that are of value are currently being produced and are spoken for in the state budget. I suppose one could consider Point Thompson or some other oil reserves that are not yet producing, but those that are producing are in are already included in your budget process. And finally, I think given the interest in gas and the movement toward toward a gas pipeline, that we're finally at a point where the gas assets are approaching a real value that can be determined as opposed to a much more speculative value.
Okay, Representative Kelly.
Yes, Brian,
I think Representative Seaton's probably hit the thorny question. Let me pose it a little differently. If the GASB approach says, well, we're able to put a value on this as it rushes into the pipe, pipeline's built, gathering fields are built, everybody would agree that would solve the problem and would meet the GASB challenge. And then completely over to the other pole, which is where we have this service station out in the middle of the Arctic slope and no car, house, or anything else can get to it yet, and GASB would say it has a zero value. You seem to argue that somewhere between this value only when it rushes into the pipe that would satisfy GASB, and where it's unarguably worth close, you know, not much now, out in the middle of nowhere without a pipeline. You see a continuum along there where sometime it gets a little easier to place a value on there on the field, different from the GASB approach, and if so, how is that?
Well, I know that oil and gas properties are commonly bought and sold in the industry, and I assume that the oil and gas properties are not sold at their book value, but rather at a value that a willing buyer would pay a willing seller. The gas on the North Slope, even if currently stranded, does have value, and I suspect that an appraiser could place such a market value upon it. I think that it's a different story what it is that shows on your books for a pure asset and liability basis, which in fact GASB does require things to be kept at cost, and what your actuaries determine your unfunded liability ratio is, which has to look at the market value. And so I believe that on a book basis the state would continue to show a deficit, but on a computed actuarial basis of the funding ratio, we would be moving it up toward the 100% level.
Mr. Chairman.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. Just to follow on, if I might, Mr. Chairman, so if we have the situation that you're talking about where it has some value and we can place and we can discover what that is, you've suggested a method where we transfer a rough estimate of the reserves from DNR into the ARM board, and they then evaluate that or appraise the value, which is kind of after sitting in front of the committee now for a couple of days, a kind of a trustless approach. How might we do something in between where before we transfer that asset, we get a handle on the value?
It would seem to me that the legislature could itself get an independent appraisal of the value. I think that that would not allow the freezing of rates for next year, but this is a long-term problem that needs a long-term fix and is not one that one would necessarily want to rush into anyway. So that would be an alternate approach that would allow the legislature to get a closer approximation than a number that DNR might pick.
Thank you.
Further question, Mr. Rogers, Representative Samuel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being with us today, Mr. Rogers. I've still got the same questions I guess I had at the last meeting. There are political factions trying to scuttle any deal that might come forward. There are political factions that are trying to pass any deal that might come forward. The reserves taxes, expansion lease revokes, and you talked about net present value. I still can't imagine a scenario until things play out a little bit that's going to allow us to have any clue on the road that we're going to be going down. And you said there's movement towards a gas pipeline, but at the current time, there's a whole lot going to happen in the next year. We'll see whether or not a proposal comes forward and it passes the legislature. or if it does not pass the legislature, what type of lawsuits will surround that legislation, what type of lawsuits will surround the potential reserves tax vote. I think a whole lot will come clear in the next year on choices the Alaskan people make, but right now, valuing the gas when you could be moving forward with the project and you could end up in court for 10 years with absolutely no movement to get a net present value figure, I think would be difficult at best. And one other thing, I know these are comments and not questions, but if you could comment on those. But last week we had testimony that project sanction is when the companies would be allowed to book the value of the resource for their shareholders, that when FERC had project sanction and they have an open season and they start going down the road of actually constructing a gas pipeline is when they can book them. And even that wasn't enough for GASB. Even that wasn't enough to value that. So that it creates yet another problem, because even if the administration comes forward with a gas deal, it's ratified by the legislature, signed by the governor, they still are going to have, I'm just picking a number here, but 5 or 6 years of the design work and the permitting work before the project is sanctioned. So best case scenario is a good deal comes forward, the legislature unanimously votes for it. That was a joke. You're still looking by the time you get through, you know, the project design and the permitting, by the time you could even the companies can do it, is book the reserves as 5 or 6 years.
If I could respond, yes, through the chair, I want to first thank Representative Samuels for raising issues, and know that when it comes to gas pipeline issues, one wouldn't want to disagree with the level of time and effort that he's put in. And I think the issue of timeline is important. A bill like House Bill 492 that is a major fiscal action has to move forward at the right time. While we want to see a solution, we do want to see the right solution, and I believe that Representative Samuels is correct that a transfer of the land assets such as this would have to be taken in context with the other actions the state takes with regard to a Stranded Gas Development Act contract or with regard to any other pipeline project. And the delay in getting a contract, I think, affects this legislation as well as other legislation, and that looking at what ultimately comes out of this legislature in any changes in tax regime and or Stranded Gas Development Act contract would so materially impact the value that final action might need to be in the context of that action. I think that would not preclude the fleshing out of the issues and the answering of the questions in that this legislation that the Finance Committee introduced by request does provide a comprehensive solution to the PERS and TERS issues. As to the issue of project sanction, again, I think that while GASB and while the industry would not formally place the value of an asset on as book value, one still, in terms of long-term plans, includes in the long-term plans the value of assets that are not yet fully booked. And those assets do have value, and if, while that value may not be able to appear on your books, it can be part of your long-term plan. And what we're really trying to address here is probably a 30 to 40 year plan to finally address the PERS and TERS shortfall, and knowing that we have an asset that is moving to to sanction, and that is has a likelihood of development would allow an appraiser to apply that probability of success to a reasonable value. There are other assets in PERS and TERS, particularly as they move into private equities, that are that have similar challenges in valuation, and there are multiple ways of addressing the valuation. But I do think these the timeline and sanction issues are important, but I also think that there's true value there. If anyone thinks that gas is worthless, I'll take it.
Fair enough.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I guess my question comes from just, you know, sitting here drawing a little flow chart, and what I look at is, you know, we have book reserves of this asset that's going to generate no income. It's non-interest bearing, so it, you know, we count on it doubling every 9 years. 75% of the payouts are anticipated to be from interest earned on deposited money on assets that are earning interest in the fund. So basically, we're not making any payments on the unfunded liability, because if we say, well, we have this asset in the future, and we're not going to increase the employer contributions, so we're not paying down the unfunded liability. And in fact, not only are we not paying down the unfunded liability, what we're doing is eating up all the liquid assets that are generating interest to pay off the past service costs as each year as we go along until this 10-year timeline or something, until we start generating some money off of it. And how does this scenario not simply deplete PERS and TERS account, the actual assets that are earning that interest to pay those past service costs? It seems to me that our unfunded ratio, our true unfunded ratio, that's assets that are earning interest to the unfunded liability, that ratio is, you know, 70% now, 69% now. It's going to go down to in the 40s or 30% funding ratio, except for monetizing future gas in the future. Am I just off base on that concept, or how do you view the structure of getting the current assets that are earning interest in PERS and TERS? How do you, under this scenario, not deplete those assets while we're waiting for gas to come online?
Through the chair, in response, no, I don't believe you're off base in the question. I do think there are two mitigating effects. First, the legislation as introduced provides for a freeze at current rates, which does have annual payments going in to toward the past service liability. It is not the full amount that it'll reach over the next 3 years, but there is some cash coming in every year from employers for past service liability. Second, to the extent that the valuation of the gas resource transferred, it uses a discounted cash flow method and uses an appropriate discount rate, each year that we move closer to the gas flowing, the value of the gas would increase, and it would be it would not be cash income, but it would be an appreciation in the value of the asset. And, you know, since we know that it's going to be at least 10 years until the income flows, the actual asset in nominal dollars that we're likely to transfer will be significantly in excess of the $5 billion laid out in the bill. But if the asset were valued at $5 billion this year and we continue to move toward bringing gas to market, it would be likely to be worth on the order of $5.3 or $5.4 billion next year and $5.7 or $5.8 billion the year after that. And so there would be an increasing value in the gas. So So both of those, I think, would offset the concern about the funding ratio.
So, Representative. So basically, what you're saying is not taking and looking at $5 billion worth of gas assets, but 9 years from now, since it would basically be doubling, we'd be looking at having to transfer in what is anticipated to be $10 billion worth of gas assets if we scheduled this to come on in 9 years.
Through the chair, yes. And actually, since some of the income would be earned even later, the total value of the royalty interest net of permanent fund would be likely to be somewhat higher than that.
All right. Follow-up, Mr. Seaton. Any questions, further questions, or Mr. Rogers on this? Representative Kelly.
Just quickly, Mr. Chairman, two other things, Brian, that get your opinion on. There's been a criticism of the asset placement in the fund to solve the problem, in that we would have difficulty then receiving from the Fed their portion relative to wages and benefits, actually to benefits in this case, on projects that are paid a portion by the Fed. That's number one. Do you see a solution to that that comports with 492? Can we get around that problem and therefore put a lower valued asset into the fund and capture some of that federal side? Have you thought about that? And the second thing is, this has been described as a future liability paid for with revenue from future periods, and some of the more hard case folks would say this is a current asset. The bill's been run up to $7 billion now by everyone at the feeding trough here, and we're going to put it off for future generations to pay it. So if I heard two criticisms that come to this, it's we won't capture our share of the Fed, and this is putting off a debt that we've run up to future generations.
Through the chair, in response, the answer to the first question is I don't know of a method that would allow us to place to avoid the consequence of this would be that we are picking up a portion of what may in the future be able to be charged to the federal share. Speaking for the university, however, I know that one of our serious concerns is that we are losing our competitiveness for federal funding as our benefit rate goes well beyond our competition, and that has one of two effects. One, we don't get some of the grants and contracts that would hypothetically pay some of this liability, or two, we have to reduce the level of staffing within a fixed grant or contract received. And so to some extent, the federal ability to pay is self-limiting, at least for major portions of the university. There would be, and one of the effects of this is, there would be some picking up of federal share. I think that the scale of that is relatively minor as compared with the significant challenge that school districts, municipalities, the university, and the state face in addressing the relentless increase in the rates. I guess I would argue we're dealing with a current liability, and that is the $6.9 billion PERS and TERS liability, I think, with a current asset, gas leases that, frankly, we thought were going to be developed a long time ago. Last month, Fairbanks Daily News Miner quoted Senator Stevens as saying financing for the gas pipeline will be in place within a year. That was in the 25 years ago today section of the News Miner. I think most of us consider this gas asset a current asset and not a future one, and so I see it matching current assets with current liabilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And yet, if we transfer the asset, it's got a value. Well, let's see. I guess it would record it at cost, which is zero.
maybe I'm thinking of apples and oranges there. I'm going to come back to that one. This is under the revenue memo. Any further questions of Mr. Rogers while we have him online? Okay. Next, Mr. Shefchik.
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure if you had fully had an opportunity to testify last week when we talked about this bill, but why don't you give us your name and your affiliation, and if you have any more testimony, go ahead, and otherwise we'll just see if there's any questions.
My name is Bob Shefchik. I'm the chief of staff for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. I did testify quite a while when you heard this bill last week. We do have a number of questions that we're working on, both from the representatives from the Ways and Means Committee here. Representative Hawker emailed a number of questions, and we have questions and concerns raised by the ARM Board meeting last Friday. In general, throughout the, I would characterize reception as positive towards a creative approach to solving a big problem, skeptical towards the details of how or even if it would work. And probably what I would say is we've identified two threshold hurdles that we need to approach between us and Representative Kelly's office and intend to work on that. One would be the constitutional challenges. You know, having we've received mixed opinions and really need a more thorough analysis, and two, Representative Seaton's, Wilson, yourself as chair, and Hawker have really asked, would you pencil out the cash flow? And those two are probably the next two big issues in terms of information that I see we need to prepare and provide for the committee, and intend to, you know, use both my own time and resources here at the borough while I work with Mr. Rogers and Representative Kelly on this. I would say if one met the thresholds of a defensible constitutional analysis and then an outline of cash flows to really show that bills will be paid without eating into the corpus of the funds that are already there, then the issues of, well, how would you, the technical, what would you transfer, how would the transfer work, who would do the management, and how would the management happen, are all difficult technical issues, but are technical issues, and, you know, and based on the reception we've received so far, we do intend to continue trying to provide the information both for the committee and the ARM Board. And I would say that concludes my testimony, and would take questions if anyone had them.
Okay, so it sounds like we got you in the middle of homework.
You bet.
All right, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think probably everyone's probably thinking this, but and not mention it, but, and so we're kind of tiptoeing around. There is always the possibility, I mean, who knows, there may be some alternative energy source that is discovered, or fuel cells, they'll figure out how that they can make it work economically, and all at once the gas prices drop, and then we're stuck with a future generation. Not only have we left the unfunded liability for them, but no way to pay for it. So I'm, you know, it could be devastating if something like that would happen.
Through the chair, I would agree that in doing the cash analysis, one would want to look at, you know, a high, a medium, and a low range of net prices on gas, and then use judgment in there. The possibility of gas prices both being volatile and being depressed for a period of time are ones that, whether it's the PERS fund or the state budget, we're collectively going to have to look at carefully. And to the extent that your question matches the one Representative Kelly asked on, are we putting this off to future generations? If you look at how we're financing it now, it's a 25-year amortization of a large debt, and we're going to know in the near term whether or not there is a gas line and whether or not the likelihood of gas flowing is really going to occur. And so to that extent, it's a different mechanism of paying for it across that same 25-year period. It doesn't change the fact that the debt exists and we intend to pay it off across an extended period of time.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Shefchik. Yeah, Representative Kelly.
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, just the Fed funding question, problem, opportunity, Bob. I hope you put that, plug that into your mix as well. And I know some of the answers for that will have to come from our folks down here. But Brian had described that in a way, talking about being competitive relative to our dealings with the Fed. When you have a burden on the payroll of in one case over 50% now, and in the other case approaching 40% of wages. Not for now, but I hope you kind of put that in your list of things to look at as well.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Mr. Shefchik. If you could just stand by in case there's a question next.
Thank you. I'll listen in.
Yeah, Representative Seaton had a follow-up.
I guess I'm just trying to figure out. You know, we're not talking about the $5 billion now. We're talking about in 9 years, it'd be $10 billion. And really, the PERS TERS schedule of payments, you know, is $15.6 billion. So aren't we really just saying that what we want to do, since all the gas income would come into the general fund, aren't we really just saying that we're going to have the state pick up the $15.6 billion of liability in the future? And we're going around different ways to get it, and we're saying, okay, we're going to keep all of the employers at their current existing rates, and the state is going to pick up out of general fund revenues, and what we're doing is moving those revenues out of the general fund today to the PERS TERS account, and we're going to pick up the entire expense and I mean, is that what this bill actually does?
Through the chair, if was that directed at me?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I would respond. I would say the answer to that would be that a portion of the costs. The intent of the bill is not to put everyone to their current rates or pare them back to the 05 rates. The intent is that the ARM board mechanism will continue to work as the way it was put in with Senate Bill 141 last year, and that assuming there was an approximate match between assets and past service liability, the rate would gravitate to the normal cost rate, which is about 13.5%. The board might want to make it normal cost rate plus 5, or, you know, the board mechanism for setting rates would only be set for a transition year, and then after that it would still have the fiduciary responsibility to make sure that it had the assets and the revenues to meet its liabilities. And so to a lesser degree, I would agree that it is looking at revenue that might become general fund revenue and saying that we're going to take a portion of the assets that would generate that revenue and transfer them to the board. But not, that's only really a part of how the bills are going to get paid into the future, and not a total absolution of how do you pay the bill with somebody else's money.
Well, and
yeah, Representative Seaton.
Follow up. I guess, you know, there's some question about what the bill, whether it fixes that current rates, and we should realize that the PERS system is not even paying the normal cost right now. I mean, with the escalator, it's not, you know, not paying the normal cost, so we're not doing that. So I don't think that that's the intent. Maybe that's just the way the wording happened to come out in the bill. But, you know, it just, I guess I just need to have somebody restate that for me so that I can. I'm not quite understanding how we have the employers under this bill paying any portion of the past service cost because the ARM board, of course, if they can't book that value, is going to have exactly the same rates that they've established in the past until those become bookable. So unless the legislature just comes in and says, we are absorbing these rates, we are going to set the rates at below the actuarially computed cost, assuming that we'll have value in this asset in the future. Is that basically where we're coming to?
No, sir. So clearly I haven't done a decent job of explaining, and we'll indeed work that into the written answers, because I do fully understand the question. Okay. And rather than use up the entire committee time on something that clearly I'm not answering adequately, I'll work on my answer for you, sir.
Representative Kelly.
Just one comment, Mr. Chairman. We've got to be careful not to think that we can treat present value of an asset, whether it's cash or gas interest, any differently from one another if we've been accurate in our valuation. So my point is, if you stick $7 billion, which is roughly the valuation's a few days old, it's roughly $7 billion today. If you stick that in the fund, or you stick $7 billion worth of gas interest in the fund, we're dealing with the present value of that, which the gas interest will grow at a rate one hopes even greater than the growth in the cash. But we've got to assume, if we value these correctly, that asset will grow apace one another. So I think it's just important to recognize that this, as Representative Seaton says, This still is an attempt to put an asset in there, whether it's cash or whether it's something else, that grows in value over time. But I think that if we've done it right, the gas interests will be valued conservatively. Their present value will then grow. We might hit a home run, we might not, but the least we better do is match cash. Investments in cash. And just one other comment, and it gets to your question as well, to Representative Seaton's question. I think we have a little bit of a doability problem here. This thing has grown since we last sat in these chairs a year ago from 5.7 to 7 billion roughly. That growth completely consumes the excess we're talking about in revenues this year. You take the amount that we're trying to figure out, you know, we want here on this, in this body, we're talking about saving more than half of it and investing in with the other part. But I think it's important to point out that while we sat, the thing grew an amount equal to our excess this year in the budget, in revenue for the budget. It completely chewed it up. And so I think that's important to point out. The other thing is that it's now 20% of the permanent fund. It's $11,000 for every member, every Alaskan. It could pay a $1,000 permanent fund dividend for 11 years. I think what I'm trying to get at is the doability of just writing a check for this. There's some folks out there that are a little bit upset that this has happened, and that they're not really ready to write a check. This may be one way that has some doability. I hope there are 10 more that we haven't discovered. But, Mr. Chairman, this is going to be a difficult one, but I hope we keep grappling with it, because it may expose other ideas on how to take care of this. It would be a match of cash, employer strains as hard as he and she can, every other thing we can apply to it, because it is massive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Barnhill, why don't you come forward? Any further questions for Mr. Shefchik? All right. Thank you for and you'll be getting back to the committee, I assume, Mr. Shefchik.
Yes, sir.
All right. And then we'll look forward to your – you're going to provide what, just a letter or something?
I expect some sort of written analysis and comments to be provided.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Mr. Barnhill, we had forwarded some questions to you, and as well as posed some questions to you last time, and you had offered some preliminary observations on any legal issues on the bill as it's structured right now. And I wondered if you could go into any of your thinking on that in any more detail, and or offer any constructive suggestions.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. If I could just start, Mr. Chair, with my own view on Representative Seaton's last question. Through the chair, in my view, the purpose of this bill is plainly to relieve employers of liability for past service costs. I mean, that's what this is about. This is one idea of how to do that. And I just want to emphasize to the committee that the Arm Board's been charged to look at all of the ideas that might be out there to solve that particular problem. And I watched a presentation last week, and I believe they came and spoke with you last week as well about the various ideas they're exploring. So this isn't the only way of addressing that issue. Mr. Chair, as we indicated at the last meeting, there are issues with this bill. The most serious of those, I believe, is the issue related to dedicated funds. Let me just give you some background on the dedicated fund issue. In 1975, our office issued an opinion that interpreted the Alaska Constitution's prohibition on dedicated funds, and it said, it's our conclusion that the dedication of any source of public revenue, tax, license, rental, sale, bonus royalty, or whatever is limited by the state constitution to those existing when the constitution was ratified or required for participation in federal programs. Essentially what this opinion is saying is it's the source of the revenue that's at issue, not necessarily the revenue itself. And then in 1982, the Alaska Supreme Court looked at this issue in the context of an aquaculture assessment that had been dedicated. And the court said, well, this looks like a tax, therefore it's a dedication that's prohibited by the Alaska Constitution. The most recent case involving dedications was the securitization of the tobacco settlement. And there, in a fairly close decision, a 3-2 decision, the court said it wasn't a dedication. The decision appears to turn on the extent to which the source of the revenue is traditional or not. I suppose there could be many definitions of what traditional is. But in that case, the source of the revenue was a lawsuit settlement. And the state has never relied on lawsuit settlements. Well, let me back up from that. The state has never relied on tobacco lawsuit settlements in the past or the securitization of tobacco lawsuit settlements. And so in that case, in a very close decision, the court said it doesn't violate the dedication clause. Now, let's look at this particular source of revenue that's proposed to be put into the pension funds. It's a gas interest. Now, the state has, for most of its history since 1977, relied almost entirely on oil and gas royalties and taxes. Is this a traditional source of revenue? Obviously it is. Can you make the distinction that it's a future gas interest reduced to present value? Sure, you can make that distinction. Is it enough to persuade the court? I don't know. If you pass this legislation, we would try our hardest to defend it, because that's what we do. But here's the cost of getting it wrong.
But there's another preliminary thing before that, and that is, can you recommend to the governor that he signs it because it is constitutional?
All things being equal, Mr. Chair, I would not recommend it, no. And the reason for that is because it appears to be more like a traditional source of revenue than a tobacco lawsuit settlement, than the transfer of timberlands to the university. I mean, so far as I know, the state has never relied on revenue from timberlands, but we have extensively relied on oil and gas revenues. And the cost of getting it wrong, Mr. Chair, let's say we pass this year and we go into litigation, we rely on this. Employers don't contribute $400 million a year towards the past service costs. In the university lands case, the legislation was passed in 2000. We got a decision in 2004, so it takes 3 to 4 years to get a decision from the Supreme Court. If we rely on this for 3 to 4 years, the cost of relying on that is $1.2 to $1.6 billion. So if we get it wrong, you know, we could be that much further in the hole. The Department of Law, you know, we appreciate the effort. There's lots of ideas out there. If you pass this, we'll defend it. But I think it's a particularly risky strategy.
Okay, well, we'll, like lawyers, we'll have to be skilled at circumvention of the law. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The problem is not the dedication of money, but the source of revenue. So if we pass a separate tax or a separate or possibly transfer of an asset as a source of revenue, but if we would appropriate money and put it into an account, that's not, does that fall under the same kind of criteria?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the legislature can certainly appropriate money from the general fund to the pension funds on an annual basis.
It's an interesting policy question. You could say any source of revenue that is a non-traditional source of revenue shall be transferred to the Armed Board for payment of past service liability.
Through the chair, if that's not a rhetorical question, under the Myers case, the tobacco securitization case, that's certainly a way that could be explored.
Representative Kelly and Representative Sanders.
If that assumption were made that it had to be appropriated on an annual basis into the unfunded liability, would that make monetization and use of that as a security instrument in the fund worth less?
Through the chair, I'm not sure I quite understand your question. Let me see if I can unravel it. If you're talking about monetization of an asset or securitization of an asset,
right,
in year one, and that monetization would go into the general fund then?
I'm talking about if you go to right there and then say, in the future, 25 years of those little one-year futures, each and every year the legislature has to appropriate the throw-off of this asset to securitize this unfunded liability. If in fact the requirement was made that this was a dedicated fund and therefore it had to solve it, one way of solving it, and law told us that this may be, each year it had to be appropriated. You had to assume then, back in year zero now, that it would always be appropriated. Does that cause some difficulty with the value of the asset?
I think through the chair we may be talking about two different things. One is, I think, valuing the asset on a net present value basis, and one is securitizing or monetizing the asset on a net present value basis. I don't think there isn't any constitutional problem, at least with respect to dedication of funds, with securitizing or monetizing an asset and putting that all in the general fund for the legislature to appropriate on an annual basis. So if this asset is worth $7 billion, and we figure a way out to securitize it consistent with the Statehood Act, and you put that $7 billion into the general fund, then you can appropriate from that on an annual basis.
Okay. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The argument that we don't rely on timber, so therefore you can take that nominal amount of money and dedicate it. We've never relied on gas either. I mean, it's my personal belief that in the future, it's the only Prudhoe Bay we've got left, and in the future there will be a gas line built sometime, and we will be extremely dependent on gas revenues. But up till now, pretty much zero. It's an oil revenues. Do you differentiate between the hydrocarbons?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, we've had Cook Inlet gas royalties since, I believe, 1959 or before that. I think Cook Inlet's been in production since the late 50s. We haven't had North Slope gas royalties yet, or if we've had, they're very small. So the question is, will the courts make the distinction in terms of geography? And, I mean, it's anyone's guess. I mean, arguments could be made both ways. If I were to bet, I would say the court would not make a distinction in terms of geography.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Mr. Barnhill. Any other observations on this one? That's about the big bullet. Ms. Bales? Are you online? Not anymore. All right. Mr. Rogers, do you have any follow-up on any of this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I don't. I think that rather than take the committee's time now, Bob and I will work up some written responses to some of the other issues raised.
All right. Well, let's just provide fodder for more thought today anyway. See how to crack the nut. Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, just a technical question. We have drafted an amendment that would put the munis in. Do you want to wait till we flesh out some of this others?
Why don't you distribute the amendment, okay, and then we can put it in the hopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Because I think what we'll do, if we're going to, there's lots more to process on this one. All right. Anything else for the committee? You know, Representative Sanders.
The other question, it kind of came up in a roundabout way, was that if we did do this, you have the ARM board acting as an entity. The DNR commissioner is working for the ARM board. They've got AOGCC to worry about, but they could potentially have complete, I mean, if you found the rest of it's all legal, you'd have a potential conflict between what the ARM board's interests were and what the state's interests were in the long term. And it came up last meeting. I just wanted to make sure that also got thrown into the hopper also.
Now, what in what respect was the conflict? Just to refresh my recollection.
You could have a governor and the commissioner who works for that governor wanting to do a particular action, taking gas, taking less gas, taking more gas, and you could have the ARM board going the other way saying, no, we want to take the money now as opposed to an action. You can see all sorts of conflicts of interest on a particular piece of, on a particular lease, where the gas is coming from. You throw AOGCC in there, and right now all roads lead to the governor, and all of a sudden you'd have the ARM board, which could potentially have a different interest than the governor did. And then the DNR commissioner is then between a rock and a hard place with a boss and a client that want different things.
Okay. We'll be adjourned to Wednesday.